had a number of meals with people this week where a lot got talked about. One of them was with my sons, and we realized as we were sitting around a table doing shots of tequila and talking that we had never in our memory just gone out to eat, the three of us. This must have happened, but we couldn't remember it. We were always as a group, a family, or one-on-one, or in various configurations, but just the three of us was rare. And it was really, really, really wonderful. I mean, it's exceptionally wonderful. And I think what made it particularly special was recognizing how much each of us, individually and as a unit, if you will, have grown. And I think what we celebrated really in our being together was this feeling of growth, of having gone through so much together and separately, individually, and having arrived at places that were substantially more evolved than where we started out. And of course, I was there when they both started out, right at the epicenter of their starting out, and watching what's taken place over the course of 31 to almost 40 years for them. And it was really beautiful. And what was particularly beautiful was how much that growth was not a manifestation so much of worldly achievement, which is where I think most people look for manifestation of growth. It was something else. It was something about who they were as human beings, something that had flowered, had evolved, grown over the course of time. And of course I felt enormous pride as a father, and love, which I've had from the moment they emerged into this world and has never gone away. But we were very able in our dialogue to look at the course of our lives, and they're still very much in the middle years of life, and they are very involved in struggle and approach struggle very differently. Josh has always liked playing and enjoying life, and is probably one of the most masterful people I've ever known at just loving being alive. Ari has always challenged himself in every possible way to become more capable, more able to take on whatever life threw at him, and then to take on more than that. So it's always been his instinct to do that. You know, he's a kid who could barely run as a kid. He had a broken leg when he was young, and took him a long time to recover from that. And the idea that he would ever become a marathon runner and a triathlete was impossible, but not to him. He took that on. You know, he took on learning how to be an airplane pilot and so much. I mean, he just keeps reaching in so many different directions. And Josh, through his deeply open heart, moved into the world of marriage and child rearing. And having become a father, has suddenly backed himself into this experience of having to work to truly support the world that he's created for himself, completely out of love. And he's very much like me. We never liked work very much, but we both backed into it in a very big way. And there comes a point where life really, really comes at you. And middle age is clearly that time for most people. You can kind of futz around through elementary school, high school, college, but there comes a point getting out of college for most people, where the hardness of life, the banging difficulty of life really hits you. And you can push that a little further, maybe you can move back in with your parents for a while, you know, but there's this whole thing of looking for work and trying to find a partner in life and those things which have become very difficult for people in this moment in time, very, very difficult. And so the hardness of life, the struggle of life becomes the thing that forces you to grow. And some people choose to embrace that. Some people do it because they have no choice. Some people revel in the possibility, and there are others who avoid it almost entirely. And it was really interesting in these other gatherings and meetings that I had this week to watch the choices that people have made in their lives and to watch how hard, I use that word a lot now, the universe has made it for people to move forward. What used to be somewhat a prescribed course of development for people, you know, you get out of school, you get a job, you work, those aren't givens anymore. You don't necessarily get a job. A lot of people aren't getting jobs. You find someone to marry. Now people don't even date. They barely go out. There's barely a boyfriend-girlfriend thing at this point in time. It's all very strange from where I grew up. And it's really hard. Sorry, I keep using that word. But in that hardness, something really fundamental starts to shift and change and emerge in people. And it's really what growth is all about. Rudy used to always talk about the acorn in the ground, you know, and this hard shell. And this very tender little thing in the middle of that, that starts to reach and push against that hard shell, and somehow, against all odds, and in some ways perhaps miraculously, breaks out of it. It cracks that shell. This is a tiny little, fragile little tendril. And it moves out. And what does it arrive at when it gets out of that shell is blackness, darkness, density, earth. But it doesn't look at that as something bad. It's almost like it's a nourishment. And it just draws through the particles or molecular nature of the world around that dirt and finds energy. And it is energy that's working and working and working, and it's moving upward. It doesn't know why it's moving upward, but it's called to move upward. And it goes, and it suddenly goes, and it's into this vast universe of light and air and blue sky and possibility. And it's like unbelievable arrival at something remarkable. And that's just the beginning of the journey. Because then it starts to kind of reach up. And as soon as it starts to reach out and branch out and dig deeper into the darkness that it's in, it starts to encounter other root systems, other acorns that are growing, other trees, other grass forms, and they are all fighting with each other for that soil they're in. And then as they start to grow, they're even fighting for the light that's above them, and they're growing, and things happen, like winter, losing all of their leaves, everything. They start to grow, and then they lose everything they've created in that sense of productivity. The leaves fall off. And if there's an emotional life to a plant, it's kind of like, oh, I'm naked. Not everything I've done has fallen away. It must be a strange psychological moment. And then, without their understanding it, all of those leaves turn into fertilizer, and they reach into the soil, and they help you grow bigger and bigger, and this keeps happening and happening. And you start to become aware of the patterning of that. So every year it gets cold, and there's a kind of discomfort, and these winds blow and knock all of the leaves off of your tree, and it keeps happening. And after the 50th time, you go, oh, this is how it works. And you just sort of settle in. You go, here it comes, the wind. It won't be bad. It'll be cold, but it won't be bad. I know what it's doing. I will be fighting off the plants around me, and I'll do the best I can to grow. You do the work that you have to do to reach out and There is a kind of competitive advantage to growing faster and harder than other things. And all of us as human beings are living the life of a tree, except we move around a lot more. And that life is deeply challenging to everybody. So there's a physical manifestation of growth. There's this thing that makes you bigger, makes you more accomplished, if you will. You may, if you're lucky in life, start to have activities that make you feel like life is rich and wonderful. You may start to do work that you love. You may have to just work to just eat and provide for your family, which isn't so much fun. And it's really hard if you can't find that. If you have the family and you can't find the work to provide for the family, that's pretty devastating. And so we as human beings have this incredible emotional life that's full of fear and anxiety and hope and ambition and all of this stuff, and we have to live with all of that. And so the middle years of our lives, that's what growth is all about. But what are we growing toward? What are you growing toward? What happens if you've become the biggest tree in the forest? Or you become a stunted little tree that never made it past the shadow of the big tree? What happens if your life didn't pan out the way you thought it was going to, which is probably 90% of people, maybe 98% of people? What happens when it doesn't work? Or what happens when it does work? At some point, this thing sets in called decay. You don't have the strength you had. You don't produce the leaves you produced. The roots start to rot. The tree starts to get weakened. Some of those lightning hits really start to find their way into the tree trunk and really do damage. You know, woodpeckers come and start to eat inside you. All of this stuff starts to happen. And growth starts to turn into the very opposite, the demise of you. And that cycle feels from the outer form to be about gain, growth, and then loss and destruction. So how do you measure your growth if it only ends up with you being whatever you finally reach as a height or a status in your life and then starts to fall away? Well, here's the secret to growth, and that is, because I was a father and watched my children and saw their pure being when they were born, their pure essence of being, because I saw that fragile little tendril of being inside them that had to break through one acorn, one wall, one obstruction after another, I've been able to watch that tender spot in them, even when it's been completely covered up with obstruction, with frustration, with the demand of the world, with suffering from day-to-day life. Even watching all of that, I can see the tendril working its way the same way that it's growing the oak tree. It's still there. That spirit of that tiny little thing is still working. And now, of course, I have the advantage of seeing it in my granddaughter. And as I look at Talia and I see this purity of being, and I'm able to relate to it in a whole new way because I have rediscovered, if you will, or awakened that tendril in myself, or my awareness of that tendril, I am aware of that in all of us. I am aware of that purity of being, that really delicate, absolute urge to crawl out of the darkness, to reach into the heavens. I see that in myself, I see it in my granddaughter, I see it in my children, and I see it in all of you. And the problem is that very few of you, and I won't be specific, and I'm not necessarily talking to those of you sitting in front of me. Some of you are going to hear this, I hope. You don't know where that tendril is. You have not found that, you have lost it. You have lost that purity of being. It's not gone. trust me, it's not gone. It's just under the layer upon layer of distraction, frustration, disappointment, busyness, all that stuff that keeps you from knowing that reaching entity that never wants to stop if you give it that opportunity. What I've discovered in many of my students, and I was having lunch with one of them the other day, was how powerful it is when that tendril is reawakened, and how amazing it is to watch people I know and care about and love who come to get this nourishment, how they grow. I watch the growth, and I've seen it in this room. I've seen it in all of you in this room. How this thing reawakens out of the sort of nutrient of meditation, if you want to call it that, the sitting still of life, the call to stillness, brings you back down through all the weightiness and all the heaviness, back down, 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 until you go to, oh, it's still there. It's still there. And not only is it still there, it is as alive and vibrant as it was the minute you were born, probably in the minute before you were born. Whatever this thing is that's so unbelievably tender and alive is there. And when you allow the energy of that to reassert itself in your life, this thing of growth happens, and not only does it affect the outer plant, not only does it affect how your life works, and in many ways, your levels of accomplishment or willingness to accept challenge or willingness to push through all of the dark, heavy, hard stuff. It's there as a kind of an enormous light in filling the world from your eyes and the world around you, and it just illuminates time and space. And you become a beacon of this sweet, soft, unbelievably powerful energy of being. And if you want the secret to success in life, it's to come from there. It's to keep hold of this. I use Spielberg as an example. This guy never once lost his touch with his child wonder, if you will, and emanates it all the time. There are people you meet who carry this with them and express it into the world, and the world embraces them for that. It doesn't give them gifts. It just acknowledges them. It allows them opportunity. It is something that presents you with more life because you put the life out there and it puts the life back. It gives back. It's a constant nurturing back and forth, and it allows for what's called expansion, growth, and evolution as an entity. And it's a glorious, wonderful thing. It's wonderful. And what happens for some people is that they get the outer part. This is another lunch that I had. And they don't know anything about this. They just don't know about this. And so they get the outer, they get all the structure, all the form, and even the success and recognition and the complications that go along with that. And then they go, It's like, oh, now what? And they just think they have to keep growing and growing and growing, and they don't even know how, and they don't know what it is that's causing growth. And they are totally dependent on outer experience for some profound satisfaction, which rarely arrives. And so I see what happens when you live a life that is devoted totally to the external. You miss out on the true growth, which is this emanation of this thing that has always been there. And this is an odd thing. You grow in some way to discover what has always been present. True growth is the arrival at what has been there from the beginning. That's the amazing thing. You don't grow into something other, you grow into what was always there. And if you can discover what was always there while you're on this journey, growth takes on a whole other kind of idea. It's no longer about getting somewhere, it's about being completely here. Being completely, endlessly connected to this tendril of vibrant, unbelievably powerful and delicate energy. That's what we're all doing. That's we are all reaching to get there, and most of us don't even know it. The decay that starts to happen, if you can stop to think about how horrible it is to lose everything, you become aware as you get quieter and quieter that there's no loss, because it all comes back to what has always been there. So that as everything starts to fall away from you, as all the aches and pains and aging process goes on, you collapse from your involvement with the outside and success and reaching out any further, and you just start to come in. And you find this thing, or you don't. And I know many people who age and don't find it, who are so caught in the outer form and the loss of form that they suffer and suffer and suffer and suffer. And then I don't know, I suppose maybe at the moment of death they discover it, maybe. But people who have stopped along the way, who have found this thing in themselves, they grow in life in ways that are remarkable. And you may not see it in the manifested world, you might, but you will see it in their being, how they are, how they react to you, how much connection they can offer you, how much love, how much kindness, how much compassion, how much understanding, how much acknowledgement they offer you, because they're there with you. They are one with you. And of course, some of these people begin to understand that this little tendril of being in them is no different than the little tendril of being in you. That all of these things that separate us, our sexuality, our personality, our worldly success or lack of success, it doesn't matter, because all of us are this tiny little thing growing. And once you acknowledge that and you reach into that in yourself and then reflect it and reach into it in the other, life becomes the very thing you were always seeking in all of your growth. The one thing we all seek in growth, which is fulfillment, wholeness, the embrace of the totality, the sense of self, the shared sense of being, the sense of wonder, the sense of mystery, the sense of oneness that we are. That's where growth begins and ends. And the journey in between is full of extraordinary experience and opportunity and a lot of things that go on, and they're all good, even when they're hard. But the coming back to this is the ultimate reward. And it seems we are all sent out of this for a reason. And we grow into the rediscovery of ourself. That's the journey that we're all on. You know, and it gets hard to watch people who lose it. It's hard to watch people who are stuck out there, you know, who are totally unaware of the journey, even people who sit, you know, and watch television all day, people who, you know, all they want to do is, you know, like play golf, whatever. Not to be critical of that stuff, because it's, you know, maybe just fine. What does a tree in the forest do all day? They'd probably be happy to watch soap operas, but it's just there. And so you have the opportunity to live an enormous expression of this or not. It's really your choice. But true growth allows you to be as big as you want and to touch it all. No matter how big you get and no matter how much all there is in your life, you will never ultimately be bigger than or more at peace with yourself than you are the moment you touch this tendril in you. And as long as that stays alive and constant, the journey will be full of wonder for you. That's why they call it the end of suffering. Because you enter into this space and it all has purpose, it all has joy, it all has mystery. And you love it. To live without that is to suffer. The rediscovery of yourself is the end of suffering. It's the enlightenment, it's the awakening. It doesn't stop the journey. As long as you're still here, it's still going to happen. But you will relate to moment in a very different way than someone who's suffering through moment to moment. So, growing is a good thing. True growth, is other than what a lot of people think. And those of you who come and sit in meditation, who find the stillness inside, who find the ability to walk back into or dig back into this elemental, tendril-like force of being, you will find what growth is really about. Any questions?
I actually have one this week.
Great.
Christopher Hitchens died this week.
Mm-hmm.
And he's someone I deeply admired, though oftentimes found myself disagreeing with. But he was a devout atheist, which got me thinking about the intersection of atheism and meditation. So I guess my question is, do you think that the belief systems of atheism and meditation can coexist?
Yeah. Well, you know, he definitely was an interesting man, and definitely Christopher Hitchens was a very smart and very articulate guy. And his real battle, more than anything, was with religion, as far as I could tell, more than God, and what God had been turned into by religious forces. I can't speak for him, but...
Well, no. Necessarily him, but just in the general concept
no,
of atheism.
No, what I'm saying is, you know, the Buddhists don't believe in God as such. They wouldn't give it that name. You don't have to... A name is a name. It's a concept. And really, you know, let's say this is the pathway to, or the vibrational equivalent of an experience of truth, of God. You don't have to name it God. You don't have to name it anything. Call it bliss. You can call it truth, silence, wonder, whatever you want to call it. Once you're there, you know it's true, and it's generating stuff. It's generating all this. It doesn't care what you call it. It doesn't care if you call it anything, or if you believe in it, or don't believe in it. It doesn't care. It just is. It doesn't walk around saying, I'm going to punish you if you don't believe in me, although what you will experience if you don't enter into it and touch it is you won't get the benefit of its wonder and joy. That's all. It doesn't care. It knows at some point probably you'll get back there. I suspect in the end every created thing gets back there. But the journey, believing in it or not believing it, isn't inconsequential. You know, there are people out there who believe through their religious practice deeply in this. And for them, the idea of God and the idea of belief and truth are absolutely essential to their life because it connects them to this. There are people who are connected to this who don't even know what the idea or name of God is, but they're living that life. So, I don't, you know, to me it's just verbiage, you know. There are people who get lost in the religion. I mean, there are people whose religion separates this from them from this. That's the hard part. Their belief system is so strong that it keeps it, makes it impossible for them to touch their own truth. They're into somebody else's belief system. That's not so great, perhaps. I mean, it may be great in terms of how it unfolds for them, but, you know, the great mystics, I mean, Teresa of Avila said she had to give up Christ to find her truth, because the obstruction of the idea, the concept, was so strong that she couldn't get here. Because she was believing in whatever one believes in, that thing out there. And believing in something out there, I mean, you can do it, but what does it mean exactly? You know, the only real thing is the thing that's rising up inside you even as we speak, that's alive and vibrating in you even as we speak. The string theory of existence, in the beginning was the Word, You know, there's this thing that's happening, that's arising, and it's causing that little tendril to move, and it's causing you to ask that question.
When I was meditating, and I noticed just in my body in general, a lot of restriction, or I've been working a lot, opening. I used to be caved in, and just the idea of, I know you've always had a strong, you said, heart center, and it feels so vulnerable. It feels like this would be the most important place that you could work from in everything, but how do you... Do you have any tips for
the tip,
when you feel like you're going to get stabbed as soon as...
Yeah, the big tip for what you're afraid of is go toward it, not away from it.
You just know that it will only make you stronger.
Well, you'll see what happens. You don't know till you do it. Go toward what it is. I mean, that's a lesson that my son Ari teaches me all the time. He always goes toward to what he's afraid of. Always. And, you know, and I've watched him evolve in ways that, you know, are totally instructive to me, because that's his modus operandi. However, I will say, we can go toward a lot of the stuff we're afraid of, but there's always a core thing. That's the one you're not going to go to. For most people, it's called death. It's a fear, and you come out of it, solar plexus. That's where you feel it. And you're going to go anywhere but there, so you can have an enormously evolved and developed life, but when it comes to the big fear, no. That one I don't want to go to. What I'm learning, because as you get older, you don't get a big choice in this, is that's where you have to start looking. Mm-hmm. It's right in that spot, and it really is solar plexus, and it's right there, and it's fearsome. And I've been talking about it in class a lot in recent time. You know, my instruction to people, to myself, I won't say to people, because what can I tell other people? But what I do is I sing to it. You know, the song I've been singing is "Hello, Darkness, My Old Friend." You know, it just seems to appease it in some way, and it allows me entry. And it's dark. It's dark. It's heavy stuff. But I have. That's where I'm going. And it's. I think it's like going back into the shell. You know, it's like digging back in through the earth. You got to give up the sunlight. You got to give up the grass. You got to give up the air and the blue sky. And you got to go back into that dark earth. And then you come to that hard shell, and you go, oh my God, I don't want to. It's so hard. How can I get into there? And then crack into that, and there. That's where you live. That's where you've lived all your life. But you have to go back. It takes courage. It takes real courage. That's why so few people ever do it. Mm-hmm. You know, Buddha said 2 million people may get the call, 2 people will get there. And why is that? Well, you know, I watch a lot of people who say they want it yet, who sit and try to get it, who are trying to go, but they, you know, they go toward their solar plexus like this. They go anywhere but, you know, don't go there. You can sit here for years and years and years and avoid it and convince yourself that you're doing great spiritual work. Mm-hmm. But in the end, which is why Rudy called this a life's work, you ain't going to have a lot of choice. You know, you can try to go elsewhere, but it's not going to be very interesting. You know, it's just, as you get older, your career's over. I mean, everything's kind of played out. So where is there to go? What can you reach for at that point? I mean, you can. People do. They take on new careers. They, you know, they do different things. But this is the journey. It's the journey back. And for the very few people who don't even leave that, then they don't have to work so hard. They just, you know. But that's, you don't just. It doesn't happen so readily. And if it does happen, you got to make it conscious. It can't be an unconscious thing.
What do you feel is the difference between the solar plexus and the heart?
You know, I've had to work with that a lot, because Rudy talked heart chakra in the chest, and he talked the navel chakra below the navel, and so there's this center right here that he didn't address exactly, and I think of that as kind of the connection between the two. And I have become much more solar plexus oriented over the last decade, I would say, and much more in recent time. But it's a very powerful space that is, in a sense, the deeper opening of the heart chakra, and an access point to the navel chakra, which is what I call this wishing and need. You know, this gets right to that place between wish and need, and it just has to open. And, you know, it's just a discovery that I've made for myself. I don't talk about it a lot. I still teach the system that Rudy mentioned, but solar plexus seems to me to be very important.
This is really interesting. When you taught me the introductory class 14 years ago, you taught me the opening of each chakra, asking to surrender, to open, to grow, a really systematic way down, and it's what I've always used. And what I found is working each chakra that way, the more I open, the more of this exquisite energy I feel. So that in the beginning when it was so scary because I felt myself falling out of myself, that was the fear. But as I began to open, there was always so much pleasure in it because there was this gorgeous energy waiting. And so for me, it was almost like a physical work to open these tight places to get what was waiting outside, which is this gorgeous feeding.
I'm in total agreement. My chakras, each one of them offers me a level of pleasure. I call it, you know, the chakra G-spot. You know, every one of them has a G-spot.
Yeah.
Every one of them is orgasmic for me. And they're orgasmic
that's
in different ways.
That's why I keep coming back.
It's so delicious. It's so delicious. Yeah. It's hard to explain. But I will tell you, the solar plexus one is a little more complicated for me. It may be for others. I have all these other chakras are in deep opening, but the solar plexus chakra has it emanates something else, and it's different. It's black hole like, but it's important, and it's arising for me. I can talk about it more in time because I'm still in exploration, but it's very, very important, significant player in the game.
I use sometimes the analogy like if you have a wet piece of paper and you put a little rock on top of it and then another one and another one and another one and eventually the paper just gives out and the rocks drop down.
Sure, sure. I mean, one of the wonderful things about this practice is that we all find the metaphors we need, and they come unbidden. They just arise because we are in pursuit, and that pursuit, you know, it's really the old adage, ask and ye shall receive. That's how it works. The door will be opened unto you, seek and ye shall find. It's very important. And, you know, and my experience for people who grow is that they knock, they ask, and they seek. And people who don't grow just don't do that. And boy, there are a lot of people out there who don't, who have been given the answers early on and don't have to bother, but find that they're drowning in their answers.
I observe them here and also in my other work doing Reiki or different other forms of vibrational movement of energy that when I let go of something or the client does, the wall cracks.
Yeah.
And it's, and I say that, you know, that they're making expansion in themselves and that molecularly moves out and hits the wall sort of when you hear the refrigerator make a noise or something like that. And sometimes I'll be laying in bed and I'll just feel this like whoosh of energy just go through me and I'll hear the wall crack. And I was just wondering if you could speak on that.
Well, I think that is your experience. And I think, you know, that speaks to you. I don't hear the wall crack particularly.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I hear things. You know, I hear whatever's happening. The train goes by.
Right.
You know, sometimes something falls onto the deck outside here. I mean, but I don't relate. I'm not trying. There's no relation to me. It's all just happening.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to relate one thing to the other and even to create the magic of that in my mind doesn't seem important because it's all magical to me. It's all happening, and it's all happening in ways that is incomprehensible to me. And yet I am a witness to the wonder of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't try to put it all together. Usually, sometimes I do. I mean, I'm always, you know, people, there are a lot of people who look at synchronicities and they think, oh my God, that must mean something. And to me, it's like, well, of course it means something. You know, it's like we're living in a realm of magic in a way, or ultimate deep truth. But trying to have one little moment signify that when every other moment doesn't seems kind of like, whoa, you know, this is amazing. This is amazing. Period. Then this one, this is amazing. And this is amazing. And this, and this, and this, and this. And it never ends.
I realize as a photographer, this and this and this, that the truest beauty that I need to find is the fluidity of stop even trying to compartmentalize and label and just let it
I mean, we each discover it on our own through our own filters, through our own sort of visual system, or let's say cognitive system, and we understand these things in whatever way we need to understand it. Ultimately, it's all the same understanding, but we're contrived in different ways, wired in different ways, so we see it differently. For you, that sounds like a wonderful realization.
I think what you just gave me, which was so wonderful, is the releasing of importance, in a sense, and it gets lodged in here, sort of. But
well, importance is a relative term, and therefore, if something is important, something is unimportant. And if something is unimportant, well, what's unimportant, really? And who's judging that? And if that is a judgment, then we start to reach for the important and try to let go of the unimportant, and then we are kind of living outside of the moment because we think we want to make that moment important or something, and therefore you don't live what is, which is kind of a mix of important and unimportant. It's kind of this, it's all one thing, you know, and certain moments will stand out and certain moments may not stand out, but it doesn't put them in a gradated space, you know. You know, I've had great moments in my life, and you can call them important, and you can look back at them as important, but they're past tense. You know, it's a mind thing that's locked on. It's a valence. It's taken an equation and it's put it in a different level. This is an important moment. This is insignificant. Okay, good. Let it go. After that, it doesn't even exist anymore at all. So it just is. I mean, that's really, it just is. And its isness is all by itself, I'll call it miraculous and totally meaningless and dull, depending upon which way you're looking at it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Is that it? Okay, thank you.